KFSR presents First Ladies Focus, the personal stories behind people who love Fresno State. Featuring Fresno State's First Lady, Mrs. Mary Castro, and KFSR Program Director, Julie Logan, 90.7 KFSR.
Good morning and welcome. I'm Julie Logan, along with my co-host, Fresno State's First Lady, Mrs. Mary Castro. Good morning, Mrs. Castro.
Good morning, Julie.
We are excited to have another very special guest with us today, and as always, I'll let you make the introductions.
Thank you. Once again, I'm very blessed to have a guest that I'm excited about sharing with the surrounding community and letting everybody know about our fantastic talent here at Fresno State. His name is Alex Espinoza, the youngest of 11 children. He was born in Tijuana, Mexico, and raised in suburban Los Angeles. He's the author of Stillwater Saints and, more recently, The Five Acts of Diego Leon. His nonfiction stories and reviews have appeared in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, the Southern California Review, the American Book Review, on NPR's All Things Considered, and in several anthologies. A recipient of the Margaret Bridgman Fellowship in Fiction at the Bread Loaf Writers Conference, Alex was recently awarded a 2014 Fellowship in Prose by the National Endowment of the Arts. He came to Fresno State in 2007 and teaches in the Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing. Alex is also the interim chair of the Department of Chicano and Latino American Studies. That's a lot, Alex. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me, and it's very nice to see you, Julie, also.
Thank you for being here. Yeah, I was reading along with you, and I'm like, wow.
That's more than one mouthful right there.
I don't know
there.
How we're going to cover this in a half an hour, so let's just get at it.
Well, the first thing that caught my eye was when Alex put on there that he's the youngest of 11 children.
11 children.
I am.
You have got to tell us the story about what it was like growing up in such a big family and your family's path from Tijuana, Mexico into the United States.
Well, one word, it was very noisy, as you can imagine. There were supposed to be originally 13 of us. My mother had two daughters who passed away in Mexico. So a big family with lots of turmoil, both good and bad. Growing up in such an environment, you know, my siblings all had a hand in raising me. Mm-hmm. I wasn't just raised by my mother. I was raised by my sisters and by my brothers and by aunts and uncles. My family, you know, my parents were both born and raised in Michoacán in a very rural part of the state, had a very, you know, about a third grade education and worked very, very hard. My father came to the U.S. when he was very young and left my mother behind and would send money. And after a couple of years, my mother got really tired of waiting for him.
I would imagine so. especially
despite the fact that my father, like, you know, told her not to follow, he wanted her to stay in Mexico, in Michoacán. Oh. And my mother was determined. She said, no, I need my family together. So she boarded a train with my siblings there were about six of them at the time. And it was late at night, my sister remembers, and they boarded a train and headed for Tijuana. Mm-hmm. And my sister recounted a story once. She told me that she remembers they only had one suitcase
for all of
their things. And it was so stuffed that it burst open.
Oh, no.
And my mother happened to have a needle and thread, and she sat there and sewed it shut.
What a resourceful woman.
So can you imagine? Everything that they had was in that suitcase. And then they arrived in Tijuana, where there were family members already there. There were people, aunts or uncles or someone.
So she had a connection for her route. She
right.
was planning it out.
Right. And then she sent word to my father that his family was there. And he came. And little by little, my mother spent the next few years going through the process of getting paperwork done so that my siblings can, you know, cross over and get jobs. And so that was how we made the transition little by little. But the funny thing is that in the 1960s, my family purchased a house in La Puente, in the city of La Puente, just outside of LA. And my father got a job at a carpet mill where he worked until he died. And in 1971, just before I was born, I was actually conceived in California.
Oh, boy. You're the Sunshine State boy.
I am. I was actually conceived in California, but my mother, for some odd reason, and there's some drama here, I don't know. She never told me. Uh-huh. She went back to Tijuana, and she had me there.
Oh.
And my siblings were very, very upset because they told her, well, he's the one that has the opportunity to become an American, to be born an American citizen. Uh-huh. And then you went back and had him there. So my mother had me in Tijuana, and I lived there with her for a couple of years.
Oh.
while the rest of my siblings were here in California. And then when I was about two or three, she brought me back. I don't know why.
Interesting.
Mm. Yeah.
Very interesting.
But there's some drama there. There was some, and I never was able to tease that story out of my mom. And, you know, so growing up, it was a really tough environment. I mean, there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of poverty. And through some miracle, I found my salvation in literature and in writing and ended up going to school.
You had sent me a copy of this essay that you wrote entitled Coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to later how you see yourself as a coyote and the different definitions of coyote. But I did really enjoy how you called yourself a coyote. So that's a little tease for people. But a program that was very pivotal in connecting you with creative writing and sparking that passion in you was the Puente Project.
That's
Can you
correct.
Talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. You know, when I was in high school, I was a horrible high school student. I wasn't very good academically. And in my high school, you either took woodshop classes or played sports. And because of my disability, I couldn't do either of those. Mm-hmm. I can't dribble a ball, and you don't want me near a jigsaw or a soldering. You know, people lose fingers. It's not pretty.
Oh, gosh.
So my teachers were always, they really didn't know what to do with me. And so in PE mm-hmm. classes, I was always given a whistle and a clipboard, and I was always told to keep score.
Oh.
And then in those woodshop classes, I could never really do anything. And then another option in my high school was getting into trouble. And I couldn't do that either. I was horrible at that. I tried getting into trouble, and it just didn't work out.
Well, that's actually good news.
Yeah, it's good news. But the only thing that I could really do was write. And I discovered my ability to write when I was in high school, and I would write these stories and I would give them to my sisters to read. And the amazing thing that would happen is they would put whatever they were doing down and they would read what I wrote. Now, at that time, I was reading a lot of, you know, in high school, it was the traditional canon. So I was reading a lot of Poe and Shakespeare and Dickens. So a lot of my stories were set in England, and there were always cemeteries. And there were always, like, you know, like...
And it was foggy.
It was
and
foggy.
Dreary.
Exactly. And then, of course, this was the 80s. So I was listening to The Smiths and, like, The Cure, like, really, like, Susie and the Banshees, all this goth music. And so I'd write...
You really threw yourself into
it. I did. I didn't waste any time. And so, you know, I was writing all of these stories, and my siblings, the most amazing thing that would happen, though, is my siblings would stop whatever they were doing and they would read it. And I saw the power that literature had to sort of make the world stand still for just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it wasn't until I got to community college. I almost dropped out of high school, and I ended up in a continuation program. And there I met a really great teacher who helped me navigate. She said, if you want to go to community college, then you have to apply for funding. And so she helped me apply for financial aid. And she gave me, you know, literature. She gave me books to read and stories to read. But it wasn't until I got to community college and I got to the Puente Project that I encountered writers writing about stories that were eerily reminiscent to the experiences that my siblings had. And they had last names like Soto and Cisneros and Viramontes. So suddenly there I was in literature. And it was so empowering. For lack of a better word, it was an epiphany. And it was in that Puente classroom where I finally heard what it was I was good at, as opposed to everybody telling me what it was I was bad at or what I couldn't do.
I love that. And you have that in your...
In the essay.
In the essay, when you say that it was so great for someone to finally tell you this is something you're good at instead of something you're bad at.
Right.
And I think that for a lot of kids, especially if they're a child who doesn't have a defined path or doesn't feel comfortable in a traditional setting, to finally make that connection that, hey, I like this and I'm good at this. And to have it reinforced by an adult or someone that you respect telling you that, that is a life-changing event.
In some ways, that's when life begins.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the thing was in that classroom, I discovered that our stories were validated. Like they could be in a book. And it was so empowering. And my English teachers, my Puente English teacher, this wonderful teacher named Judith Ashton, said to me, you know, what everybody else is struggling with in terms of, you know, you get that all your peers sitting around this table are struggling to compose this essay. And to you, writing is just like breathing.
Right.
And I said, no, I don't. And she said, it is. And you really need to pursue that. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like, well, what can I do with it? Mm-hmm. And they taught me more than anything to pursue my passion, be that, you know, underwater cave exploring or medicine or writing mm-hmm. or philosophy. The people in the Puente program taught me to pursue what it was I was passionate about and not necessarily go after the money, right? It mm-hmm. was, what do you like to do? What do you do best? And go out there and seek that and ask for it. And no one had ever said that to me.
And how do you think that we can do that now to the next generation?
I think one of the important things that we can do right now is invest as professors, as academics, invest more time and energy in cultivating the artistic and creative endeavors of our students.
Yes.
Really encouraging them to feel like the academy is theirs, that they have a stake in it, that they can dictate the terms and that they can decide in which direction they want to take their life. I think that more than anything, we need to develop curriculum that reflects who our students are.
Great.
Our students, especially our students of color, mm-hmm. need to see themselves represented in the material that they're studying in the class.
Right, they have to identify with
it. They do, absolutely, because that's what happened to me in literature.
You mentioned that you would spend a lot of time in the Thomas Rivera
Library,
and when I was sharing your essay with Joe,
mm-hmm.
he said, I spent a lot of time mm-hmm. in that library.
Really?
Joe did a research project on Thomas Rivera. And you'll have to get together with him to learn more about that. But he was also a big role model for him. And he's a Chicano writer who became the first Mexican-American chancellor of mm-hmm. the UC system. And Joe studied about his struggles in that role. And
wow.
So that's wonderful that you had a connection with him, too, and that he touched your life in such a personal way.
Yeah, you know, it was my first year at UC Riverside. I graduated from community college in 1994 and then spent a couple of years in L.A., selling furniture to a bunch of rich people in Santa Monica. And I'd get yelled at all the time. It was no fun.
I'm trying to imagine you selling furniture.
It was not pretty. No, I was actually good at it. I have to say, retail was my thing. And then I did the unthinkable. I actually called my mother one day. I still remember. And my mother lived in Colton, which is, if listeners out there know anything about Southern California geography, Colton is like way inland and it's a lot of railroad tracks and factories. There's really nothing out there. Mm-hmm. And I left LA, which was like the heart of culture and fun, mm-hmm. to move back to Colton. And I called my mom and I said, I need to move back because I need to go back to school. And the only thing I had on my mind was, I need to figure out this writing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back. And
what was your mom's response to that? To you calling and saying, I'm going to leave my job to pursue more education for writing?
She was incredibly happy that her baby was coming back
home. Oh, that's right.
And so she was actually very, very happy. And she was very supportive also of my decision. And so I came back and I started UCR in 1998 and I declared creative writing as my major because I just saw the box and I remember people saying, well, you're always a good writer.
So just, I saw the box.
You know, it's like, so I checked it.
You said, that sounds like me.
That sounds like me. And one of the first classes that I took was a world literature course. And the TA in that class gave me one day, just out of the blue, a copy of Tomás Rivera's And the Earth Did Not Devour Him. And she said, I still remember, I hope that someday you will write stories that reflect our culture and who you are. And I still have that book.
Wow.
And I still keep in touch with her, Edith Vasquez. And it was in this really wonderful professor, Stephanie Hammer's class. And then that was when I discovered, again, it one step further. And there was a great professor at UC Riverside that I worked with named Susan Strait, who's a wonderful California novelist, who also took me under her wing and said, you know, this thing, you do it very well. Let's help you cultivate it. And Susan walked in the very first day. She's this very short, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed gringa. And one of the first things she was talking about was the way in which in literature and in writing, we need to reflect who our characters are and that every character, every community is worthy of being chronicled in literature.
Yes.
And she said, you know, for example, like, and she talked about the language that we use to depict our characters. And she said, who here knows what a ranfla is? And no one raised their hand. And I was the only one that raised my hand in the class. And I was sitting on the floor because it
what
was so
packed. What is a ranfla?
Yeah.
It's a lowrider.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to pretend I knew what you just said.
You know? You know, being from Fresno, you'd think I'd have known that.
I know what a lowrider is. Yeah, I just didn't know
but
that was the...
A ranfla is like a lowrider. You know, it's like a car. And so I was the only one that knew what that was. And instantly what happened was, you know, that space was created for me. Like, oh, okay, mm-hmm. then my language, my purpose, my presence here in the academy fits, mm-hmm. right? There's a space for it. And also this professor was saying, I give you license to write those
You're
kinds of
stories.
You're
the specialist, yeah. right?
And so what happened was, you know, she instantly sort of gave me that power. And I think that that's also one, going back to your question about what we can do to foster that next mm-hmm. generation, is we need to give them the power and the ability to create those spaces within the academy so that they can flourish, right? And we do that through giving them the license to say, like, you can write about this place. Yeah, uh-huh. you know, who wants to hear about a novel about a bunch of characters from Dinuba? Well, Manuel mm-hmm. Munoz did that. Mm-hmm. You know, who wants to hear about, you know, a novel set in Parlier? I think that we have to teach our students to really hone and craft the ability to tell their stories from that these disparate stories, places.
That's right, that their stories are valuable, that their stories are unique to people who are not part of this culture,
right.
to people who have no idea what it's like to be in mm-hmm. the valley. They're reading it with as much excitement as you were reading those novels about
exactly.
the English countryside.
Exactly.
Everyone is foreign to someone else.
Exactly.
And we can value that and celebrate it. And there are unique points of view that our students have that they can share with the world, mm-hmm. and it is a huge contribution.
Exactly.
A compelling story is a compelling story, no matter where it comes from.
Right.
It doesn't have to be from some major metropolitan area.
Right. We always
to,
think
yeah.
that it has to be this grand event.
Yeah.
But oftentimes, the things that touch people the most are those common things that bind us through humanity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right.
I like how you talk about how mentors affected you. I think it's really important, too, for a person in your position, and I know that you do this, but to open yourself up, to be on the lookout for opportunities to be that mentor mm-hmm. to the next person, to encourage that student who maybe doesn't know whether they're fitting in or not.
Exactly.
To make them feel welcome. And especially on our campus, you know, being a part of the Bulldog family, there are so many different ways that we can support a student and to help them towards being successful beyond just academic advising. There are a lot of aspects to the student's success that we need to be responsible mm-hmm. for. And I know that you're active in a lot of different community events and programs. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, right now I'm Special Assistant to the Provost for Diversity Outreach and Initiatives. And what I'm working closely with the administration to see if we can develop programs within our hiring practices to be able to attract more faculty of color. I'm the chair of the Department of Chicano and Latin American Studies right now. And, you know, we're hosting a bunch of events. I help organize a group of faculty on campus into a group called LACA, Literatures, Arts, and Cultures of the Americas. Mm. And we are a group of faculty brought together with our shared interest in issues that are relevant to the hemisphere of the Americas. So Canada, the U.S., and Mexico and Latin America. And we share research, we share resources, we put talks together because I was finding that we were having these conversations with each other, but there were people in history that I wanted to work with that I couldn't. And then there were people in social work education that I wanted to work with but couldn't.
So you found a way to bring them together.
So we found a way to bring them together. We're planning a big event for Hispanic Heritage Month in September and October, and I'm working with a group of new first-year Latino faculty who are very energized
Great.
And very focused, and we're planning a big month-long event. I work closely with community organizations like Arte Americas to help them, you know, organize events. I have contacts with people in Fresno City College. So I think it's important that as faculty members of the university that we put ourselves out there, mm-hmm. That we make strong connections with the community, because we're all taking a hand in, I think, educating our students of the Valley. Education just doesn't happen here.
Yes.
It happens beyond. And I think that that's really important for faculty to sort of start seeing themselves as part of this sort of community outreach efforts to really educate, because there's so much education that goes on beyond the classroom.
What are some exciting projects that you see coming up in the future?
I've had the pleasure of working with some individuals in Sacramento. And what we're hoping to do is, my big dream is to develop a California Book Festival similar to the one that takes place in Texas. And we would like to take this opportunity to really develop something that is going to look at the literature and pay homage to the literature of the great state of California. And so that's in the pipeline.
That sounds really exciting.
Mm-hmm. Very exciting.
and you know, taking our cues from Texas, because mm-hmm. they've instituted a really successful book festival, statewide book festival. And so I'm working with this group out of Sacramento, and we would like to do it in the state capital because it makes sense.
Sure.
But of course, I'd like to include a Fresno component, because I think that oftentimes the rest of the country sort of doesn't look at the Central Valley as a hub of literature. Even though we've had great, successful writers come out of here, mm-hmm. usually publishers in New York City ignore the population in the Central Valley. And what I would like to do is create that demand through...
Put a spotlight on it.
Exactly. And and celebrate it. And through this idea of a California Book Festival, having it be very Central California located, I think would be really important. So that's in the pipeline.
Great. Now we'll get to how you see yourself as a coyote.
Okay.
And one thing that you had mentioned in your essay was that sometimes students will hold up a book of yours and say, how do I do this? And what
right.
they're really asking you is, how is this even possible? What are the steps to it? And for many, it's something completely foreign.
Mm-hmm.
Who helped you navigate that process? And what did it feel like the first time you held your own published book?
Who helped me? I had an amazing network of teachers, of writers, my friend Susan Strait, who told me very early on, if you want to do this, mm-hmm. it's going to take a lot of work. She said, just get yourself ready. And she's very no nonsense. And she said, you know, I'm going to tell you that you're probably crazy if you want to be a novelist. But if you want to do it, you're going to do it no matter what. And so she gave me, more than anything, the tools to really succeed. She told me that I needed to read a lot, and I needed to read good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she made me want to work really hard to achieve it, because she taught me that stories coming out of those places like Colton or, you know, these small communities are valid. They need to be told.
Mm-hmm.
So she helped me really, really a lot in navigating that. And I actually worked on my first novel while I was a student of hers. This was at UC Riverside. And then when I got to graduate school, I met another group of really wonderful professors, Jeffrey Wolf and a really wonderful writer by the name of Michelle Atiolet, who really honed and tempered me and taught me really well what a good piece of literature is supposed to do, what it should
Great.
Do and what it shouldn't do. And I worked on that book little by little by little, and I just honed it mm-hmm. and crafted it and really loved it. And I think that I always tell students, that's what you need, is you need to really love the characters that you're writing about, the stories mm-hmm. that you're telling. And quite frankly, I didn't think anybody would be interested in reading a novel about a old woman who is living in a community much like Colton, called Agua Mansa, and an old woman who runs a botanica, this shop where you go and get herbs and tea. No one's going to be interested in that. I've got, uh-huh. you know, a punk rocker and just a motley crew of all these different characters. And
uh-huh.
no one's going to be interested in this. But what I did was I said, okay, if I'm going to do it, then I'm going to do it. And I'm going to write the kind of book that I would want to read more than anything.
Oh, I love that.
And so I just sat down, and that was my task. And uh-huh. I met a literary agent at a writer's conference one day while I was there. And I was really tired. I'd been to two conferences. And by the time I got to this one at Squaw Valley, the community of writers at Squaw Valley, I was just beat. And this agent said to me, so what are you working on? And I said, I was very glib. It's just like, I don't know. I've got this book about a botanica. Do you know what a botanica is? Of course you don't know what it is. Nobody knows. And it's a botanica.
That probably what attracted him, that you were trying not to sell your story.
Exactly.
And drew him in.
And I just was so glib about it. And uh-huh. immediately this agent walked over to me and gave me her card. And she said, can I see that when you're done? And I said, yeah, of course, but I've still got work to do on
uh-huh.
it. And she kept harassing me. And so finally, and one of my professors at Irvine said, you know, that doesn't happen. Like
right.
literary agents of this stature don't actively pursue writers. And so I finished it up and I sent it off, and I just said, there's no way she's going to want it. You know, she's not going to want to represent me. And lo and behold, she did. And so I think
nice.
one of the things that it takes is, you know, I tell students, you have to learn to love to read
mm-hmm.
if you want to be a writer.
Right.
You have to be willing to put yourself in a room for several hours alone.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be willing to share your work and sometimes get negative criticism for it. That's how we grow.
Well, you're very vulnerable when you allow someone to read something you've written.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you can, I think an MFA program is a good, strong way for you to hone that ability. You know, we have a great MFA program here mm-hmm. at Fresno State with dedicated faculty who work really hard to make sure that their students succeed. I think that you have to be willing to put yourself in those positions of vulnerability if you really want the world to look at something you wrote. But think about the power in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, a book has the ability to change the world.
Right.
Right. So
to reach people even beyond your lifetime.
Exactly. And there were moments when I would receive emails from people. I received an email from a woman in England once who read Stillwater Saints, my first novel, and said, you know, I saw this book in a gift shop in England. And like, it was like in a, she said, we're on the coast somewhere. And she said, and I'm originally from Los Angeles. She said, so I picked it up on a lark. Thank you so much.
Nice.
For creating.
Great feedback.
She said, I haven't been back to California in years. Uh-huh. Thank you so much for shortening that distance.
Oh.
She said, suddenly I was there.
That's wonderful.
And I received another email from a woman once in Nebraska.
Wow.
And she said, you know, I'm an older white woman, but I read this book and it reminds me so much of this community here mm-hmm. called, I don't remember the name. I received another email from a friend once who told me it was like timestamped like 4 a.m. And this friend said, I just want you to know that it's 4 a.m. and I just now finished your book. And I couldn't put it down.
Well, that's it. When you can't put it down,
yeah.
you just really become taken up in the story.
Right. So I think that putting ourselves in those positions for our craft is really, really important. I think that's what I tell people.
And it's good for students to know, too, that you are going to be going outside a comfortable zone.
Right.
It's not always going to feel good, but stick with it. It's rewarding.
Right. And I think that I'm going to plug our MFA program here at Fresno State because we've got some great faculty. You know, in nonfiction, we have Stephen Church and John Hales. And in poetry, we have, you know, the wonderful Connie Hales and Tim Skeen. And then I'm myself in fiction, and my colleague in fiction is Rhonda Girard. And we really, more than anything, value the unique perspectives of our students who come to study with us about the craft of writing. And we really want to help them hone their voices. We honor their voices, their differences. And I think that a good program, a good writing program does that. And that's what I tell students is seek out the writing conferences, the MFA programs, because if you really want to do this, you have it in you. Your story can really change someone's life. Who knows? Something that you have to share, that you have inside of you, that you might think is very, you know,
insignificant.
Yeah, insignificant. An experience that you had, you can sit down and write about it, and that could change someone's life.
Well, thank you, Alex, for taking that chance and being the vulnerable person who wrote things down that could change other people's lives. We are very blessed here at Fresno State to have you as a member of our faculty, and I know that there are many great things that you're involved in now and going forward. I would encourage our listeners to go to the kfsr.org website to follow the links to where they can see pictures of the covers of your different books and of all the exciting things you're doing.
Thank you so much, Mary. This was wonderful.
It was so nice to get to know you. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us on
Thank you,
Sunday
Julie.
Morning.
Both of you. This was wonderful.
Thanks again to our very special guest, Alex Espinoza, and of course, my co-host, Fresno State's First Lady, Mrs. Mary Castro. Thanks for joining us this morning. Please join us again next Sunday morning at 10 for another First Ladies Focus on KFSR. We're on the air at 90.7 FM and streaming worldwide at www.kfsr.org.
KFSR presents First Ladies Focus every Sunday morning at 10. For a complete program schedule, visit kfsr.org.